10 o'clock, so let's get this Government Operations Committee meeting on the road. So I call the meeting to order. The people will take their seats, and thank you. So we get out of the way, and don't forget it. Representative Hansen, have you read the minutes?
Yes, I'd move to approve them.
Motion is made to approve the minutes of the January 23rd meeting. Any questions? Any corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's passed. First item on our agenda, and the only item on our agenda, is House File 5. And Representative Atkins, would you come down and describe the bill and to get the bill going here? I make a motion that the House File 5 be recommended to pass and be referred to civil law. So the motion bills before us, and Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill. Mr. Chairman, do you prefer to have the author's amendment go on at the outset? I don't know if you're quite at a quorum, or do you want to do that after I do the walkthrough?
Well, we have a quorum, so why don't we put it in the order you want, and that's House 823. So I move House or H005 A23 amendment, which is the author's amendment, to be passed. Any questions of the amendment? Let's put the bill in the order that the author wants it. Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I think that our members are going to have some concerns with this. We can either put it on right now if we want, but I think that some of our members aren't necessarily going to are going to perhaps have an amendment that maybe counteracts some of this, so maybe Representative Atkins could talk about it a little bit beforehand.
Representative Atkins, why don't you explain the amendment then?
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pepin. I prefer to, because there is a little bit of substance to this, and Mr. Shepard was kind enough to point out that we had a slight constitutional snafu in the bill. Like the bill as it stands would not be constitutional relative to the appointment process. So, just thinking it might be wise to fix that before we keep moving forward. And this is the committee in which to take up the amendment. The amendment is straightforward. It just, under the original draft, it allowed for the appointment of the board by the House, the Senate, and the governor. Each had a couple appointments, then the DHS commissioner. Mr. Shepard was kind enough to point out to us that was not the appropriate process to follow. The Senate made a change that provided for the governor to make appointments and then do Senate confirmations, which is one that we're familiar with. In the House, the only difference between what went on in the Senate, which my understanding is that was also at Mr. Shepard's prompting as well as Senate counsel, the only difference here in the House is that we would make it subject to House and Senate confirmation. We happen to think that House members have just as much stake in this as the Senate does, and it's not unheard of for the House to take on a confirmation role. That's the essence of the author's amendment, and it will put it in the shape that not only do I prefer, but also a shape that makes the proposed law constitutional.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in effect, we're creating a brand new agency for the governor.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, I would describe it as a hybrid between a state agency and a complete spinoff or nonprofit. It's not much different than, for example, the zoo board. The PUC might be, I was talking to Representative Ayler yesterday actually about that, and it is an opportunity where the governor would make some appointments, but there'd be quite a bit of independent operation of this entity as well.
Representative Quam.
So if this is a hybrid agency, your amendment doesn't include some of the oversight and normal checks and balances given the legislature on, some of the entities that are agencies.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, no, it does not. The bill does.
Representative Quam.
Actually, reading the bill, I felt that it would neglated many of the chapters that do have oversight, transparency, open meeting, and some of the other things that we'd normally see. So you're saying that you're changing this to make it constitutional, but not taking care of the inadequacies in the present form of the bill for oversight, transparency, and openness?
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. I'd be happy to discuss that as we walk through the bill. This is merely an author's amendment at this point to put the bill in a fashion that Mr. Shepard believes will be past constitutional muster, and also provides, it's good that I just kept talking, because in fact, Representative Quam, it does provide for additional oversight, and that it provides for both Senate and House confirmation of the board members. So thank you for giving me that opportunity.
So the motion before us is now here to put House File A-23, put the bill in the shape that the author intends, and that's what we normally do. And all those in favor of House File or A-23 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Ayes have it. Representative Atkins, can you explain your bill and
I'd be
go from there.
To. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members, for giving the opportunity to have this bill heard. A couple quick overview comments, and that is, number one, keep in mind that we have two options here. We can either adopt a statewide health insurance marketplace, or we can have the feds do it for us. We are given an opportunity between now and March 31st in which to do it on a state basis. If we don't do that, then the federal government will impose an exchange of its own creation upon us at a higher cost and in all likelihood, well, not in all likelihood, guaranteed a higher price, but also, in our opinion, at a lesser product. Minnesota is well known across the country. In fact, there's other states that are looking at us because we've got a great health network. We've got great docs. We've got great facilities. We've got good insurers. We've got something to be proud of here in Minnesota. And it's important that to the extent that we can continue to exercise control rather than giving that up to the federal government that we avail ourselves of that opportunity. What an exchange is, or what I've taken to calling Minnesota's online marketplace for health insurance, I just call it MOM for short, is what MOM will provide is a competitive online marketplace. My mom's watching, I think. Is this on TV? If it is, my mom didn't want to go out driving today because it's the roads are icy. She was going to sit home and see if there were any good legislative hearings. So, Mom, that one was for you if you're watching. Minnesota's online marketplace for health insurance will provide a competitive online marketplace where individuals, small businesses, and entrepreneurs can go to buy their health insurance products, unlike anything we've had in Minnesota before. The prediction is that 1.3 million Minnesotans will find their insurance through this marketplace, that it will save the average Minnesota family $490 a year, that Minnesota businesses will, in addition to saving 7.5% as a result of more competitive premiums, will also save a total of over $150 million annually as a result of not having to pay the MCHA assessment. Those are just some of the highlights. What I did want to do is a walkthrough, and Mr. Chair, you feel free to interrupt me at any. I've taken all of the government operations provisions, and I will walk through that because I think that's what this committee would be most interested in, and then I'd be happy to take any questions. I also understand that there is testimony that folks would like to present to you today. The first section of importance is the establishment. It's Section 4. Subdivision 1 talks about the purpose of the exchange of the marketplace. You can read those items for yourself. I won't read the bill to you. I'm just going to try to do my best to jump through and give you a summary. Section 4, Subdivision 2 are certain exemptions. But it's important to point out, and Representative Quam, thank you for already calling attention to it, that the exchange is still subject to review by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. That's the reference to Minnesota Statute Section 3.971. It is subject to review by the Legislative Auditor. Board members and staff are subject to the Conflict of Interest Statute. That is Sections 10A.07 and 10A.071, which are referenced in the bill. All meetings must comply with the Open Meeting Law. That's Chapter 13D, with typical exceptions for negotiations, contracts, and certain non-public data. The marketplace is exempt from Chapter 14, that's rulemaking, and Chapter 16 B and C for procurement, Section 16 E for the Office of Enterprise Technology. That's a nod to the fact that this is supposed to be a nimble, market-driven entity, entrepreneurial by nature, something that Representative Rezkowski, I'm sure, would prefer, because it can react then to the market rather than be dictated to by what government has to say. Governance is in Section 5. Did you like that, Representative Rezkowski? The board consists of 7 members. We just took up that author's amendment, folks, and that is what I already described, so I won't go back through that. But it would remain a 7-member board subject to confirmation by the House and the Senate. As Representative Quam noted, we want to make sure that there's considerable oversight, and that's just one more way as a result of the author's amendment for which we would have oversight on top of the legislative auditor, on top of the Department of Commerce, on top of the Department of Health, on top of federal requirements, plus all of the criminal statutes, the anti-fraud stuff, the Attorney General's office, and I've got a whole list that I'll pass out. But those are just the ones that I can tell you off the top of my head relative to oversight. Subdivision 2 in Section 5 goes through the appointments. Again, the author's amendment addressed that. And the final member is the DHS commissioner. Subdivision 3 just describes what the terms of those serving are. Conflicts of interest is also referenced. Subdivisions 5 through 11 in Section 5. Lay out the framework by which the board can constitute itself and provides guidance on the practical functions that the board must undertake. This is nothing new. I believe Senator Rest, former House member Rest, was the mother of most of this in terms of how it how a board constitutes itself. It's just the basic ups or startup provisions that apply. Subdivision 12 allows for a per diem payment for the members. I believe that's $55 per meeting plus reimbursements of things like mileage and so on. Subdivision 13 allows the board to establish advisory committees. In Section 6, we talk about the powers of the marketplace. None of these will really surprise you. The board can employ staff and delegate certain responsibilities as appropriate. There's the compensation that's set by the board. And I want to call particular attention to this. The compensation is set by the board for the staff. It's also then reviewed by the MMB and approved by the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So again, Representative Quam, yet another element of oversight in that the Legislative Coordinating Commission, of course, is us. It establishes its budget, it raises revenue, it contracts for goods and services, it enters into information sharing agreements with federal and state agencies, provided that adequate protections are in place for the data. It takes other actions reasonably required to administer its responsibilities. Most of that is all standard sorts of things when this board is, or any other board would be established. Section 6 is relative to appeals. This is not an arbitrary situation where once the board decides there's no opportunity for appeal. This does provide people with an opportunity to pursue an appeal. Section 6, Subdivision 7 is regarding agreements and consultation. It says there should be an establishment of an agreement with the state CIO for purposes of administering IT in coordination with public health care programs. It establishes an agreement with DHS for services regarding eligibility and enrollment for public health care programs. There's an agreement with the Commerce Department and health departments to enforce the certification requirements established by the board. And the board may establish agreements with Commerce and Health for other services as well. There's also consulting with Commerce and Health regarding the operations, also consulting with Indian tribes and other organizations regarding the operations, and establishing an advisory committee for healthcare industry representatives to provide input relating to the operations of the marketplace. Just a couple final sections, Mr. Chair, and then I'll be done with the GovOps elements. Section 9 is a report to the legislature, another piece of oversight. Section 10 is the expiration and sunset exclusion. This does not sunset the marketplace. The point of that is this marketplace is anticipated to continue into the future. Section 11 is also traditional transition of authority. Once this, assuming it's enacted, stands out or walks through the handoff of MMB's responsibilities to the new marketplace itself. Mr. Chairman, that's a walkthrough of the government operations pieces in the bill. But that said, I'd be happy to stand for whatever questions people may have about it, or if you want to take testimony, it's whatever you feel most comfortable with, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And members, just give kind of a roadmap what we're going to do here. I know we have one testifier who has a commitment, has to be out here by 11. So we'll start with some questions, but I'm going to try and get that one testifier to be able to get here so we can give his speech, and then we can continue asking questions and go on from there. And if we get time, then we'll get to the rest of the testifiers. So, Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the author, brought up the sunset exclusion, but part of the function of the sunset board is to review and to be able to go through, look at, and give some feedback for improvements and review that process. And I don't understand why you're getting rid of the Sunset Commission totally, because you're getting rid of that review and oversight. You don't have independent financial auditing. You don't have similar requirements that we have in our managed care plan. Mr. Chair, okay, you're back. Thank you.
I was listening.
You don't have, some of the things that we have on our managed care plans, and I would think that if that oversight was good for the managed care plans, that you would want to include, some of those independent audits and, checks and balances we have for managed care plans.
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative. I didn't hear a question, though.
Well, actually, the first question when you were, that's why I was checking to see if you're listening, was
why are
you getting rid of the review process of the Sunset Commission? Because it's not just sunsetting, it's reviewing the operation of all the agencies underneath the governor in order to be able to, and of course your amendment creates this as being an agency, and therefore we periodically review to try and improve them, and it's not just getting rid of, it's to make government better. So why wouldn't you want that review to make the exchange better?
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. And I appreciate the inquiry. It sounds like you've answered your own question for yourself, but the reason is twofold. Number one is we don't anticipate this entity sunsetting. But number two is because we've built in, and there should be a handout now to your left elbow, of all of the, I think we've gone one better relative to the oversight. And I'll leave the federal oversight pieces on the top of the page for you to read, but the state oversight goes well beyond just what the review of the sunset entity would provide for. Specifically, in the bill itself already, is for the seven-member board appointed by the governor that is now accountable to both the House and the Senate, and we are accountable and elected by the public. It subjects the exchange to the office of the legislative auditor. And I don't know of a member in this body, Mr. Chairman, or Representative Quam, who doesn't hold the legislative auditor's office in extremely high regard. Number three is it provides for strong conflict of interest provisions for the board members, which ensures the exchange is operating in the best interest of the public. It requires an annual report to the legislature on the performance of the exchange, meeting its responsibilities and an accounting of its budget activities, subjects the exchange to the open meeting law with certain exceptions, as I described earlier, subjects the board to the state's conflict of interest statutes, requires the board to establish open and competitive procurement processes. In addition to that, the legislature may, at its discretion, conduct hearings on the activities of the marketplace, or alter or repeal statutes governing the exchange to the extent it believes it's warranted. Finally, we've got current state law, which requires any state employer or officer who discovered evidence of fraud or embezzlement or theft to report that, and the Minnesota False Claims Act, which I know you're familiar with as well. So not only have we, I mean, you talk about belts and suspenders. We've got federal oversight, we've got state oversight, and we've done state oversight on steroids for this organization.
Representative Kwong.
So you don't think the review of the Sunset Commission is important, but you still haven't answered why do you not include the same independent audits, the same review we have of managed care plans in this review? I mean, we're talking health care, Minnesota, federal oversight, fine. Minnesota tends to be a little bit more creative. I think we do a better job than the feds. And so why are you neglecting? Because the exchange seems to be somewhat managed since you select who's going to participate. Even though the Commerce Department, you know, certifies your cherry picking, you know, who's going to participate. So why are you not allowing something that's designed to monitor, you know, health care and health care plans to be a check and balance in your exchange?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kwong. And to the extent perhaps I misunderstood, nothing changes, by the way, the Department of Commerce or the Department of Health's abilities. They still have all of those opportunities to independently review any product that is offered in the marketplace. And perhaps that's where you're going. I'm not quite sure.
Representative Kwong.
Mr. Chair, no, actually I'm going as in the exchange, because this is a whole new entity. We brought managed care because that would help certain portions of our state. And I think in many ways it has. So I understand from your discussion that you think the exchange will improve and manage portions of our healthcare system. So why not have those same, you know, auditing activities, independent auditing activities, and those processes that we use for that one managed care improvement to cover yours, which I would argue is managing, you know, the health insurance similar to, you know, managed care, but more global and far-reaching.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwong, and I, my apologies for not completely understanding. I think that what you're referencing is what's already in federal law. And that is that there's, and that's why it's not built into this bill. There's also already, by federal law, a required external outside audit. And maybe it's just that you weren't familiar. That's why it's not built into the Minnesota law. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair.
It's in the top portion of the handout.
As I stated before, you know, the federal government does stuff, but the Minnesota state legislature and our entities, I think, do a much better job, more effective, and we have initiated processes on our own because, you know, frankly, I don't trust the feds to run, you know, our health care as good as we can. So I'm just trying to understand why, you know, things that we do and implement on a state level, because, you know, I want this bill, I want to know what's in it and understand it before it's passed, unlike, you know, as we've been told by, you know, many people in the know and the feds, that you have to pass it to know. Well, I'm here to try and understand and know, and that's why I'm asking, you know, Minnesota processes. I guess I'm uncomfortable when we exempt agencies from Minnesota processes that we've done and built up over the years to protect our citizens from unintended consequences. And, you know, that's why I'm trying to understand.
Representative Atkins.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the concern, Representative Baum. I share your concern. We didn't put it in the language of the bill because there's already a federal audit required, which we have access to, as do the folks, people in Minnesota, as do the plans and brokers, and everybody will have access to that. So So there is an audit required. If it would belt and suspenders it in, we can reference that in the bill. But moreover, we also make it, on top of what the federal law requires, we make it subject to our own legislative auditor and an independent audit performed by the legislative auditor. So we'll have an independent outside external one that's required by federal law. We'll also have it available for audit by the legislative auditor.
Mr. Chair, you already are removing some of the audit and review with the sunset review, but last year we implemented independent third-party audits for HMOs. Now, that's a Minnesota thing that we did, and we thought it was required and improved the system. And so, again, I think falling back on, the feds, I still check my oil pressure and I check my tires and that, even if they do it at the gas station. And I think Minnesota, even if the Fed has a process for checking these things, that's why we have, the institutions we have, is that we double check and we're responsible for watching over our people. So to foster it off on the federal government, responsibilities that we have been taking care of, I wouldn't find that comfortable for me.
Then, Mr. Chair, Representative Bump, I think you just simply misunderstand. It's not the federal government that is responsible for the. It just federal law requires that there be an outside independent audit. We didn't feel the need to build that into our own. If you'd like to, we can. It doesn't require anything different. It's already part of the law. And I endorse an independent outside auditor taking a look at all of the operations on a regular basis.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I think you are to be commended in your foresight on exempting this from the Sunset Commission. The Sunset Commission doesn't have a great track record so far of sunsetting anything. And, in fact, it itself could be subject to a sunset at some point soon. So I think you're better to steer clear of this, and I'm pretty sure that the state auditor is going to perform this function very well. So I think that's a very good section of the bill, and it steers you clear of entanglements that you might not want later.
And Mr. Chairman, to Representative Winkler's point and to Representative Quam's point, I've heard the same discussion that the Sunset Commission may be sunsetted. Again, this is belt and suspenders. If that Sunset Commission goes away, we still want to have this subject to its own independent audit and to the legislative auditor. So we've far from trying to get around oversight. We have put in more oversight and making sure that it won't go away in the event that the Sunset Commission does. Thank you.
Representative Winkler. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I have a question about line 6.6 in here. I'm just glad to see the strong conflict of interest provisions in this legislation. Line 6.6 is just the provision that allows the exchange to seek and accept money, grants, loans, donations, materials, services, or advertising revenue. I can understand why the exchange might need advertising revenue. I'm just wondering if there's any if you see any potential conflict in allowing the exchange to seek and accept grants and loans and donations from parties, some of whom might have an interest in the business before the exchange.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Freiberg, and thank you for pointing that out at the outset of your comments. We have built in exceptionally strong conflict of interest provisions into the law already. It's our understanding and expectation at least the exchange staff be it the McKnight Foundation or other philanthropic organizations might see fit to support an organization like this. And no different from any other website. If folks want to advertise on it or something like that, we may avail ourselves of that possibility as well. The point is to operate in as entrepreneurial and competitive of a marketplace fashion as we possibly can. But your concern is well noted, and we tried to build in language to the statute to prevent any sort of conflict from arising.
Representative Freiberg, follow up? Okay. Representative Kahn.
My question was, when are amendments going to be considered? When are amendments going to be considered in the schedule?
Thank you, Representative Quam. We did the author's amendment first, and which is traditional, yes, that we allow the author to put it in the shape that he wants it, or he or she wants it. The rest of the amendments, we're going to do testimony, we're going to take questions and answers, and I don't think we're going to get wrapped up today. If we get to the point where we're at quarter after 11, we may start doing amendments and maybe get it passed today, I guess, but I'm a eternal optimist. We have this scheduled for tomorrow also, so we'll be probably doing the amendments tomorrow.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Struskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Atkins, for bringing this bill. You know, Representative Atkins, this is probably, since I've been here in the legislature, this is the most extreme piece of legislation that I've ever seen here before us at the legislature. And you know, you mentioned that this will provide for entrepreneurialism. That seems to be an oxymoron given what I see in government today. So I'm kind of curious as we dig into this further and try to learn about how we are going to engineer a piece of government to do what the private sector does. I just find that to be very interesting, as I mentioned, an oxymoron. Several questions, and Representative Atkins, your assertion around your amendment, which I'm still trying to catch up with, and I think I've caught up with it, but you mentioned that the bill as initially presented had some constitutionality conflicts. I'm curious, and maybe Mr. Shepard could outline those for us again, but I'm guessing it appears revolves around the separation of powers that maybe didn't exist before, and there was an attempt in this amendment to weave some of that in. So I'm just wondering if we could review what those changes were and what Mr. Shepard's, what his direct concerns were, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I had brought to the attention of the author that while the case law in Minnesota on separation of powers and specifically legislative appointments to executive agencies is about 100 years old and not really clear, that I thought there was at least an issue with having legislators make appointments to an executive agency, and that that would potentially raise concerns under separation of powers and the governor's appointment authority. And so when I raised those potential concerns to Representative Atkins, and he decided to change the structure of the board as reflected in the A23 amendment so that there are no longer any legislative appointments. They are made by the governor, and so that addressed the concern that I had raised to him.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe Representative Atkins or Mr. Shepard could answer this too. Do we know for sure that this super agency that we are creating here is indeed an executive department agency? Is there something in the bill that indicates that it is?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, on page 2, line 2.22 of the bill, it references that the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace is created as a board under section 15.012, paragraph A. And if you read section 15.012, paragraph A, refers to an agency in the executive branch. And so I concluded from that this is an executive branch agency.
Mr. Chair, to that point, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Representative Truskowski, for raising the issue. We are, as you might imagine, and as my answers to Representative Quam's concerns, we are bending over backwards to try to be as careful and cautious about how we approach this as we can. So when we hear even the slightest bit of constitutional concern, we try to figure out a way to address it. The board itself is constituted under, I believe it's 15A.012. It's referenced in the bill itself. So it's akin, for example, to the Minnesota Zoo Board. It's not, and while you have certain discretion, certainly to call it anything you want to, super agency, I think was what you named it, we're actually endeavoring to have it be somewhat outside. So it's not like the Department of Commerce. It's not like the Department of Health. It's got an ability to run somewhat on its own in a more entrepreneurial, competitive, marketplace-driven fashion. but we also are wrestling with the fact that it's got to be able to plug people into the public programs. Literally, if you go online and you meet the certain qualifications for eligibility, you'd be able to get into those programs that are offered through the state. The only way that we can do that and pass federal muster is to have it be constituted in this fashion that's been spelled out in the bill, so under 15A.012. Does that make sense?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins specifically, I'm looking again at your author's amendment, lines 1.3 and 1.4 and also 1.9 and 10. It says, with the advice and consent. I'm just kind of wondering how this advice and consent will work. Is there a particular type of way that advice of the House and the Senate is provided to the governor, and I'm assuming then that there is some sort of ratification process. Can you explain?
Representative Atkins.
I could, but I'll bet Mr. Shepherd would do better. And I think in an effort at the greatest amount of accuracy, I'd prefer, if it's all right with you, Representative Drazkowski, that we look to Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the term advice and consent is used often in other statutes to refer to a process for legislative confirmation of executive appointments. And so the one example that you may be familiar with in this committee that has had an executive appointment come before it is the appointments to the Board of Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure, which require advice and consent of both the House and the Senate. And so there's a process under which the governor's nominee is submitted by a letter to the appropriate officers in the legislature. Those are then typically referred in the normal manner to the committee with jurisdiction over the matter. And eventually that committee would make a recommendation, and the full legislature, the full House, or the full Senate would then vote, having the term is sort of a term of art, having advised, they would then vote to consent to the governor's appointment or not.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shepherd. For the author, obviously, what we're looking at is the governor making the appointment of all seven of the members of this board. Do the members have to be Minnesotans, I guess, is the first question, Representative Atkins. And then the other question is, can the architects of this bill, the people who have drafted it and provided the behind-the-scenes efforts to develop this idea, this plan, and this bill, are they people who could eventually be appointed by the governor to be members of this board?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, if I remember the two questions, the answer is no and yes.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. So it sounds like they don't have to be Minnesotans, but the people who did develop a design and write this bill could eventually be appointed to this board by the governor. I appreciate that. Last question, Mr. Atkins. You said in your opening statements, Representative Atkins, in your opening statements that this will save $490 per year per family. Do you have your calculations for that, or maybe that's something we'll see later?
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I don't in this packet. I'm fully prepared relative to the government operations portions, but I didn't. I've got a huge stack of other supportive documentation, and expected that would be an item in the finance committees and commerce and health. But I can certainly supply that to you, and will.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. Representative Drazkowski's question led me to another question that I hadn't anticipated asking right now, but the second part of his question that you answered affirmatively to, so a person that has been part of writing this bill would not be considered a conflict of interest, yet people that know anything about the industry apparently would be considered a conflict of interest, and I just have a comment that I highly would suggest you consider if going forward, if you would consider also making sure that those who wrote this would not be also allowed to be sit on this super agency, as I'll call it. But that's just a comment. My question was, getting back to some of the questions that Representative Quam asked before, I'm not sure that I'm completely satisfied. My, you know, couple thoughts. First, Representative Winkler's not here. I have to say that I am very disappointed that Representative Winkler is, you know, big on sunsetting the Sunset Commission, and I think that's really unfortunate because I would think that both parties would want to make sure that government is operating as effectively and efficiently as possible. It's only a year old, and while it's true that we haven't been able to sunset a lot, that is mostly because of members of his side of the aisle not willing to look at streamlining government. So Representative Winkler's not here, unfortunately. I wanted to make a comment to him earlier directly, but I think it's really unfortunate that as a legislature we're not interested in making sure that we're getting the best bang for the buck for a taxpayer. And I think that we should always do the best that we can to make sure that we review any board or agency to make sure it's still the most effective and efficient possible for the residents of the state. So that's also a comment, I guess. But my direct question, I guess, is, Representative Atkins, is I see that the board exempts completely rulemaking. And I know you kind of touched around the borders a lot. And I don't understand why we would want to eliminate the rulemaking. And I don't understand why. I guess I don't know how the public and stakeholders would give back to the exchange. You said that this is sort of supersized on accountability, but that's not the way I view it. And you know, perhaps Mr. Shepard could comment about what other state boards have been exempt from the rulemaking process. And I guess I don't really understand why this is the route you're going. If you could maybe hit that a little bit more directly, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Atkins, and before you do, after he gives his answer, I'm going to stop questioning and let the one individual who needs to testify be out of here by 11, and then we'll go back to Representative Pepin for her follow-ups. So, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pepin. To your first point, the question that Representative Drazkowski posed was whether or not the governor could eventually appoint someone who was involved in the writing of this bill or somehow otherwise involved. My answer to that was yes, and that's true, but it would still be subject to, if that was deemed a some sort of conflict or that a year had passed or something along those, or a year had not passed. That is it's still subject to those conflict of interest rules. That being said, I take your point. I get your point. With respect to the rulemaking provision, the point of having exemption from rulemaking is primarily a timing issue. And that is there still are all of the protections that these are open meetings. Everything is subject to the legislature's review, the legislative auditor's review, the open meeting laws, all the various things. The exemption of the rulemaking process is because in order to, and perhaps there's folks here that are from the health plans and insurers and brokers who will describe to you that the marketplace is a rapidly changing, or can be a rapidly changing entity. And it's very dynamic, and to be able to respond to that, the point was to have an ability to respond rapidly and nimbly in a fashion that meets with what the marketplace demands. That being said, it also bears mentioning, though, the Department of Commerce's role and oversight authority has not changed one bit. So to the extent that the board would have run averse in any fashion, in addition to the auditor and so forth, the Department of Commerce would also have a right to step in. Again, it's belts and suspenders. So thank you for raising the question.
Again, I'm going to call Rich Neumeister down here. He's wants to give some testimony, and then we'll go back to Representative Pepin to follow up on her questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Government Ops Committee, I'm very much obliged to you for the few moments that you have given me. For those people who may not know who this character is, with the mustache, long hair, whatever, over the years, I'm someone who's been here for 3.5 decades, working in a nonpartisan way, working with members of all parties on government accountability, privacy, open government, and other kinds of things. I'm going to speak specifically to sections of this bill. I'm not here, as Caesar said, you know, the old Caesar comment, to bury Mom, as you called this new, but to help improve Mom. It's happening. You got to. I'm one of those people that believe get in the battle, make some suggestions, but you know, important ones that I think are important. One is, let's say, Mr. Atkins, Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins indicated this is under the open meeting law. Accountability, there's state oversight, there's federal oversight, but one of the important ones is public oversight, which involves individuals, groups, and all that. One of the ways to do that is by going to public meetings, getting nuances, getting aspects of discussion, which create then discussion in the public venue. Under the proposed bill, and if you go specifically on page 5, and you go to lines 312 and 313, those sentences swallow the intent of the open meeting law. Now, you go back to the original open meeting law, which is 13D, and you go to 13D05 subdivision 1, paragraph B, basically all other public bodies have a balancing test of when they can close meetings. And, it, you know, I'm not here to read it out, but it's basically meetings are open and non-public or not public data can be discussed when it's within the scope of the public body's authority and is reasonably necessary to conduct the business or agenda. That's why a lot of public meetings are open. What happens here is that's all closed out. That balancing test in the original law is no longer there. It shuts it out. So, and the other point on 3.8 of that and 3.10, there's discretion as to what personal negotiations and contract negotiations are, and I have concerns about what that means and whether or not there will be a vote taken. And it's a broad term that does not happen with other kinds of public bodies. You can say if personal negotiations and contract negotiations are discussed in other public bodies, what's wrong with this public body? And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the last part is on dealing on page 9, section 7, dealing with data. I've heard different points of view on this from Democrats, Republicans, people who are familiar with data practices, people are not. One of the tools that you look at for the community to be able to make sure there's accountability, no matter what type of entity it is, creature, whatever, or mom, is the ability to use data practices to get information. Some people are saying that just having Section 7 in here basically neuters other aspects of the Data Practices Act. That's the case. And if there's a need for comfort language, just put in when things like this are created historically that I've seen, you'll just put mom or the marketplace, whatever, shall be subject to Chapter 13. And two other notes that relate to this. One is that specifically characteristic of legislation, when there's data sharing, it's real specific with what you're sharing. The language in here is very broad and lets the board decide. So I'm suggesting, based on things I've seen, like this and others, is that be specific with what kind of data is sharing. Because there are legitimate concerns to be addressed. And finally, Mr. Chairman, government operations is a very important thing because it's one of the that interacts with the individual. There's still quite a number of significant people that are not online, don't care to be online. So when the health insurance exchange is fully implemented, I hope you think of a number of people, older people, people who are making decisions, just don't want to be online, that there be a process or way to still participate in the health insurance exchange. So I've been seeing that more and more, there's still that digital divide, there's still that ability of issues of impediments. So a good program like the exchange is trying to do, it shouldn't subvert itself by just saying you can only register online. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I graciously thank you very much for the few moments. This is the first time I've had to make comment on this bill, and I hope to work with the author and others on the concerns I've brought to your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And we have one question for you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, Mr. Chair, just a clarification on Mr. Neumeier's comments. I appreciate you being here today, Mr. Neumeier. The references that he had as I was following in the bill didn't match up with what he was talking about. So he's talking about 512 and 513, and that is a partial sentence and then talks about removal of members from the board, and I don't think that was jibing with what he was referring to. The same thing in 3.8 through 3.10. However, on subdivision 7, or excuse me, section 7, we were kind of back on track. So I'm just wanting to make sure that members had clarity on what he was looking at. So if they were marking up their version of the bill, that they had that. So maybe we can look for clarification.
I believe he meant page 3.
Yeah. Right.
Because when he said it, he said page 5, but then he said 313 and 3.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, just to clarify, sometimes in the rush you turn the numbers around.
Fair enough.
Referring to pages, page 3, basically subdivision 2, line 312, 313, about the open meeting thing. And then I'm referring to the section 7 on the data practices where my points are made. If you're going to take a look at some of the language, I'd just say get rid of section parentheses 3. But that's your choice as the bill continues on its adventure and journey.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister, and members, and thank you for the last piece about the online registration. I know my mom is one that doesn't use a computer and refuses to use a computer, so that I know there are a large number of people and many people out there that can't afford the internet access that it's an issue for them. So thank you for your testimony, and we'll revert back to Representative Pepin with her questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. I want to get back to the rulemaking. And, you know, you talked a lot about expediency and being nimble and setting that up, and I guess I can sort of understand that and setting up, but going forward, why would we need an exemption going forward once it's set up? Are there specific rules that exist that would get in the way or prevent it from doing its job? Going forward, what would be the problem with the rulemaking process? Because that's really a sticking point for me, that we're exempting this.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, you're right. It's two distinct issues. One is the startup and the time frame that we have to meet in order to comply with the federal government or have a federal exchange imposed upon us. Then there's the second piece, which is more to the comments that I made earlier, which is the dynamic marketplace in which health products are offered. Is one in which if the more rapidly that you can respond, the more likely it is that you'll meet the needs of the buying public, no different than any other individual business. That was the, and with to that point, however, it might be a little bit, we might be a little bit more able to accommodate. Perhaps there's a relative to rulemaking, there's a fashion in which we can do it still expeditiously, but not the full-blown approach that we have under the current requirement. So I'm not foreclosing the possibility. I'm just saying that we do have two distinctly different issues, one at the startup and then once it's operating.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. And I appreciate what you're saying. I think a lot of agencies might say the same thing about whatever rule it is that they're trying to push forward. We hear that frequently. It's important that we move this forward, and there's always a timeline. And so I think it's kind of a slippery slope when you're going down this road. And frankly, I'm concerned about the lack of transparency. And I'd hope you would be too. Do you know? I guess I have kind of two follow-up questions. What other of our state boards have been exempt from the rulemaking process? That might be a question for Mr. Shepard. And then, what are other states? Are there other states that are exempting their exchanges from the rulemaking process? Do you have information on that? And if we could get that, that would be great.
Representative Atkins, do you want Representative Atkins to answer first, or Mr. Shepard to answer first?
I'd actually be interested in what Mr. Shepard has to say, also relative to other.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, there are other agencies. The committee was discussing earlier the concept of sort of quasi-governmental agency or quasi-executive agencies, and there are a variety of agencies, particularly in the economic development area at the back of Chapter 116 of Minnesota statutes, that are set up that are not subject to all the laws that govern executive branch state agencies. They're subject to some, but not all of them. And so some of those, Minnesota Technology Incorporated, some of the other economic development agencies have been set up in a way that I believe they do not need to follow the state rulemaking process. And that would probably be the best example I can think of. There have been other agencies, and you probably remember coming in front of this committee times when the Department of Natural Resources or the Department of Transportation have sought exemptions for rulemaking for particular types of activity that the committee believed, even on an ongoing basis, needed to be done quickly every year. setting hunting seasons, for example, where it has to be done so quickly that it's not feasible to go through an extensive process. So those are the kind of things that come to my mind.
And, Mr. Chairman, to the second portion of Representative Pepin's question.
Representative Atkins.
The latest figures we have is that eight states, there's 10 states that that have gone through this at this point. Eight of them have exempted their marketplaces from rulemaking. Two have considered them to be applicable to rulemaking, or having the rulemaking requirements applicable to them.
Representative Kepp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. It sounded from Mr. Shepard like there weren't any major agencies. It was some smaller items that got expedited through rulemaking, which I've recalled, and a couple of other small things.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, I think it's just the ones that are most tuned into and have the most demanded by the market of them. So when we talk about economic development agencies, that's a great example of one in which that we've got a dynamic market that needs to be responded to quickly and nimbly, as opposed to a process that might take several months in which to react.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Representative Atkins, just getting back to the flexibility, I'm wondering, you know, this is just really a problem that a portion of the bill that I struggle with. I'm wondering if you could provide some examples of when flexibility would be necessary, because I'm concerned about this super agency being able to pick carriers, might be just a couple, without public review. And so I really struggle with that. Could you give me some examples of when you really feel that this flexibility is going to be necessary going forward for rulemaking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I might, if I could phone a friend for something more. We have a little bit of a handicap in that the executive director is in Washington, D.C., complying with the federal requirements today. But we've got some folks here from the marketplace staff that might be able to describe some scenarios. If they're available to answer that, I'd appreciate it.
Is there somebody here from the staff coming forward? I see somebody coming forward. Could you please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Reich from the Health Insurance Exchange. Representative Pepin, one example that is in the bill are certification requirements that I believe it's subdivision 6, section 6, excuse me.
Page 8.
Law. Under federal law, the ACA requires that the health insurance exchange promulgate certification standards for plans sold through the exchange, and those have to meet certain federal guidelines, and that is one example where if to the extent we want to go above them to adapt to the marketplace or change them to be more flexible, that would be one example where the rulemaking portion exemption would be useful.
Representative Sanders, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, Mr. Reich. I'm confused a little bit about that. We talked a little bit about this in the Commerce hearing as well. Could you explain why the board needs to have the power to establish certification requirements for the health carriers and the health plans? Why the Department of Commerce could not be able to do that? I know, Representative Atkins, you said earlier that Commerce's role would not change one bit. I know you're talking about to comply with federal guidelines and exchange will be X, Y, and Z. Why cannot the Commerce Department fulfill their role in that? Why does the Health Insurance Exchange need that role as well?
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, and I think Mr. Reich may have referenced it. I just wanted to make sure, relative to the last item, that members are aware of lines 6.16 and 6.17 regarding rulemaking. And that is that the board shall establish policies and procedures to gather public comment and provide public notice to the state register. We're not trying to get around, as rules are made, we're not trying to avoid public comment or public transparency or public criticism, for that matter. That's built into the bill. Specific to your question, and thank you for your indulgence, I just wanted to make sure that members were aware of that. I believe what you're getting after here is the so-called active purchaser role. There's a two, actually, I guess arguably a three. First, you've got plans that would develop products that could be sold. Next, they'd have to meet a certain bar to be certified as available in this grocery store of healthcare products or health plan products. And then finally, the exchange board, the marketplace board, would have an opportunity to negotiate with those that have met the certification, would have an opportunity to actually negotiate with those to try to drive towards the best, most affordable, highest quality, most fitting products that would be available to folks in the marketplace. And that portion has, I understand that there's some controversy about that. The plans will tell you that once they meet the certification, they would like to know that their product is going to be available in the market. And that bar may be very, very high in order to get into the market. Folks who support the current language in the bill would say that we can drive it even to higher quality, and that's what some other states have done, by having the plans then have to negotiate with the board to put the very, very best products available at the most affordable price.
Mr. Reich, would you want to add here?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, with respect to your second question, the federal law requires that the exchange set the certification standards, and if you'll notice on page 9, there is a provision that we shall establish and maintain an agreement with the Commerce Department and the Department of Health for them to enforce those standards.
Mr. Sanders, Representative Sanders.
I will pass for now. Okay. But thank you for answering the question.
Representative Peppin, we're back at your.
Yeah, I'm still learning about the certification requirement, and I'm still having a hard time understanding why after it's initially set up, after 180 days or whatever it is, and even setting it up, why it really seems to be a lack of public input. Maybe you could help ease some of my concerns on that.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peppin, I appreciate the concern, but we actually put it into the bill itself so that there would have to be that public comment and public notice and open meetings. At least in original thinking on the drafts of the bill, that wasn't necessarily in the bill, but we wanted to make sure that we explicitly said so. And I don't know how you can say it any more clearly than in the lines that I referenced on 616 and 617, which is policies and procedures to gather public comment and provide public notice in the state's register.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. Well, I guess the problem I have, it's the board's doing this, and I just am not seeing the accountability or the public input. It seems like this is just a super board with very little accountability, and so it's just an overall, I don't understand why this has to be out of rulemaking. I'm just having a really hard time with it. You know, I guess I can pass for now. We can hit it again later.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I want to go back to the open meeting provision. And you've served in local government, and we have a couple different open meeting requirements. And in local government, the open meeting provisions prevent the cascading phone calls because you have a limited number board. For example, I couldn't call you, and then you call somebody else, and somebody else calls somebody else. Are the provisions in the open meeting law that you're having in the bill a local government open meeting law, or are they the traditional open meeting law that we're subject to?
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I might, I don't know for sure. And Mr. Shepard may be able to provide some assistance, but the point of the open, everything is open with the exception of those, for example, contract negotiations that you, for obvious reasons, you don't want to be having those discussions and sharing those with whoever you're negotiating with in terms of what your negotiation strategy is. Those are the only exemptions that are placed in. But as far as how it squares up with the state versus local specifically, I could be about 90% right. I'll guess that Mr. Shepard could be 100% right.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hansen, on page 3.6 and 3.7 of the bill, it requires that all meetings of the board shall comply with the open meeting law with certain exceptions. That references to the open meeting law that governs all local governments. So it's the one that applies to cities, counties, school boards, and all.
Representative Hansen.
That would be the right one in my estimation.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, a series of questions that you probably have talked about at Commerce, but having been a past Commerce Commission member and someone who's a little experienced with the insurance industry, I do have some questions. But before I get to that, on page 8, subdivision or section 6, subdivision 6, dealing with appeals, can you kind of outline for me a course that someone who might have been rejected or has an issue with their application for insurance on the exchange and the route that might take in an appeal process?
Representative Atkins.
I can try.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll. We've got, as noted in the language itself, the board will conduct hearings and appoint hearing officers and recommend final orders related to any appeals. It bears noting, though, that in Section B, you've got the marketplace may establish service-level agreements with state agencies to conduct hearings for appeals. That, I think, stands on its own, but I wanted to point out the reference to Section 471.59 because that is MA eligibility appeals, and those still go through DHS to handle. Also referenced down below in Section 256.045 is a reference to Medicaid appeals, and those would continue in the traditional fashion. But I think in the language itself, you've got 8.22 and 8.23, where the establishment of agreements with those state agencies. 8.26, the marketplace would be represented by an attorney who would be an employee of the marketplace. And I'm apparently getting help from friends. Okay, that's from Phyllis. Thank you, Phyllis. That is not a help from friend.
Wow.
Not on this particular issue, no, anyway.
Sorry.
But the appeals process itself, I mean, you've got the board represented by an attorney. You go through and appoint a hearing officer, but the traditional Medicaid, Medicare appeals remain the same.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I guess Representative and Chair Atkins, what I'm wondering is, Will an individual still have the ability to go through an office of an administrative hearing on this and appeal to district court if they're not satisfied? The things that you're talking about are codified in law that deal with some specific types of coverage or specific types of plans that are already offered. Would we have the ability as a consumer, if we weren't satisfied by the internal appointees, to be able to...
Representative Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I completely misinterpreted where... I thought you were talking for the Medicare, Medicaid folks, so that's why I focus so much on that. As far as the OAH and traditional ability to go to court, yes.
Okay.
Is the short answer to that. I'm sorry I misunderstood where you were going with it.
Well, learning more about the bill.
Representative O'Driscoll. Are you done?
I'm done on that, but I did want to also talk about some other questions that I had as I reviewed the bill relative to Chapter 60K.
Representative O'Driscoll, then. Go ahead.
Chapter 60K deals with licensing in the state of Minnesota, both of carriers and of individuals. And in 60K, it talks about an insurance agent or broker would need to go through approved state training as approved by the Department of Commerce. Carriers would have to fill out applications to be considered admitted carriers, which would then allow them the ability to be able to sell product. Carriers would then have to accept appointments from those who are licensed in the insurance industry. You had said that there isn't going to be any change, if you will, from Commerce's participation in this. But a word that I picked up on says that the exchange has to quote-unquote certify, certified, or be certified. And there is no explanation of what certification means in the definitions. And then it also says Commerce will also do that. I was just wondering if you could explain how that's different or the same or relative to the admitted carrier process in the state of Minnesota. Okay.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. That's a terrific question and one that I think I've understood. As opposed to the last one. I think we've got two different pieces of certification. One is we've got what the Department of Commerce already does and will continue to do in no different way by virtue of this proposal. The second is wherever the health insurance marketplace will set a certain level that for products in order to be sold within the marketplace. That could differ from what the Department of Commerce. Department of Commerce takes a look at those individual products, make sure that they comply with state requirements, and will continue to do that. The board would have within its discretion the ability to raise that bar, perhaps, to next, you know, so you've got already certified products by the Commerce Department. The board may have a little bit higher requirement to get products into that that grocery store market, that marketplace of insurance products. And then there's the final piece that's in the bill as it's currently drafted, which would be the ability for that that board to then negotiate and select which of those products are the best ones to be offered within the marketplace.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, one of the provisions to be an admitted carrier in the state of Minnesota, and I'm assuming that all carriers would have to be admitted and they may go to that second phase of being included or not included in the exchange, is you have to participate in the reinsurance program in the state of Minnesota for health insurance. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to the provisions and how that might continue to work, or will the exchange have the ability through its rulemaking to exempt people from participation in that if they choose that they don't want to? So if the insurance carrier that was admitted or allowed to participate in the grocery store becomes insolvent, how is the consumer protected?
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I don't believe that they would be exempted from that. I will look to my right or left if there's members here from the exchange staff or from Commerce. But I believe if you want to participate in Minnesota's marketplace, you will have to comply with what Minnesota law requires.
Representative O'Driscoll.
The navigators. Are we anticipating any licensure oversight for those individuals, since it looks like they're going to have as direct of contact with consumers as those who I referenced earlier have to hold a Minnesota insurance license, be subject to, as Representative Davids continues to remind us, continuing education. And his views on that. Can you speak to the qualifications or standards that the navigators would need to possess in order to have access to consumers in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Atkins.
Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I have in my materials some notes relative to navigators. Mr. Reich may have that more off the top of his head in terms of what is going to be demanded of navigators. They, by the way, are entities as opposed to individuals, which sometimes folks, you know, we talk about the agents and brokers and the demands that would be made of agents and brokers individually in the continuing ad, which in fact I believe was Representative Davids actually that offered the amendment. But as far as the navigator and the navigator program and the demands of that, Mr. Reich might be better able to give specifics as I search for my notes.
Mr. Reich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Driscoll. There will be some training for navigators in order to be certified to operate within the exchange. Some don't know the specific requirements, but some general requirements that the federal government is likely to require for navigator training are things around eligibility determinations, how that works relative to the tax credits you may be eligible for or Medicaid enrollment through the exchange. So just simply understanding how that eligibility process works and enrollment. Even something I'll go back as basic as how does the exchange work. That will be part of the training. And then you go into the eligibility, how that's determined, some of the rules around eligibility from the federal law. Additionally, some of the privacy laws that apply to the exchange, whether it be through information that a consumer is submitting through the exchange and divulging to a navigator around income or other demographic data, they'll have to understand those privacy laws. Lastly, the advanced premium tax credit is just that, a tax credit to help subsidize the premium of a policy bought through the exchange by a consumer who's eligible. And that tax credit is going to apply immediately if you're determined eligible. And as you move through your life, essentially, as an eligible enrollee in the exchange, your income could differ. And so you may move from eligible to ineligible throughout the course of a year if you make more money, get a better job, or something like that. That will have to be reconciled at the end of the year. You may owe some money if you continue to get that premium tax credit. And so that reconciliation process is likely something that the navigators would have to understand and be able to divulge and make consumers aware of as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Chair, I guess delving into the navigator a little bit more, Who's liable if the navigator doesn't provide accurate information or misinformation or erroneous information? You said it's an entity. Is that entity going to be liable then to the consumer, to the state, to whom on that for that? Because we know what happens under 60K. That's pretty clear.
Mr. Reich. Or Mr. Representative Atkins.
Well, I was going to say, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, in addition, there is also the within 30 days of enactment, there's requirements that are going to be set up for in-person assisters by MMB. And I think, as I was looking for my notes, I think Mr. Reich covered everything, but there's the provision, I believe it's, at least my reference had it as 7.27 and 2.8. Is a set of requirements that will apply to those people. And I use the two almost interchangeably as far as navigators and in-person assisters. The fact is they are not interchangeable. But when we get down to the person, the individual level, there will be requirements of those people in addition to what that will be set forth by MMB within a month of enactment of this. Specific to your question, nothing in this, nowhere in the four corners of this bill will you find anything that changes liability law. So to the extent there's a misrepresentation, to the extent that there is a contract that's not been fulfilled, to the extent that there's been fraud, to the extent that there's been any sort of negligence, we don't change the laws in any fashion. So if it's no different than if I went to you for advice and you gave me poor advice and I relied upon it, there's Minnesota common law that would require that if you messed up, I'd have damages that would I'd be able to avail myself of in a claim against you. Not that you would ever give me bad advice, but.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I think it's the final question, this depending upon the answer, I guess. Representative Atkins, what do I tell insurance agents who have been contacting me in my district and from all across the state? Am I going to be relevant after the exchange is there? What's my role going to be, and how do I provide service to consumers if there are navigators, and what role do I have as a small business owner and the people who are working for me? Do I become irrelevant? Do I go away? Do I have another competitor in the marketplace?
Representative Atkins.
Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, there's been no better question asked today than that one because and I'll give you, dating back about a year ago, there was a reference that this is like the Travelocity for health insurance. It's not. I can sit down and buy an airplane ticket on Travelocity and understand it pretty well, and probably a lot of people can. But the fact is health insurance is still a complicated product, and people will benefit from having someone with a lot of experience and background and training and education who can give them good advice about what product to buy. So if anything, I think the role of agents and brokers will only be enhanced by the fact that we're going to have 300,000 people, additional people in Minnesota, currently uninsured, who are going to be purchasing their product. This isn't my number. This is the health economist that was hired. $300,000 or 300,000 more Minnesotans who will buy their insurance. We're going to have 1.3 million Minnesotans who are anticipated to purchase their insurance through this. I would be shocked if many of them don't avail themselves of the help that a good agent or a good broker could give them to find the best product that's suitable for their needs.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a final comment. I'm sure that's going to come as welcome news to those who are currently practitioners in the industry, that this bill will open up more opportunities for them, but they still had shared a number of concerns, only with scratching the surface of the concerns that they've shared with me, have I shared with you today.
Well, and I suspect, Mr. Chairman and Representative O'Driscoll, their concerns would be magnified tenfold if it was a federal exchange that was dictated to us with federal rules as opposed to one that's being operated by people like Representative O'Driscoll and other legislators who have oversight over that board and actually care about those agents and brokers who are doing business here in Minnesota.
Representative Pugh, and before you start, just so everyone, again, so we have the roadmap at 11:30 when our meeting is supposed to be up. We're going to lay this bill over for tomorrow, and we'll continue on, and I'll keep the list that we have here if people asking want to ask questions, and we'll start up with that list tomorrow when we start back up. So, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. My question is with regard to, and actually back to, the projected savings of $490 that average Minnesota families can expect. So my question is, what recourse do taxpayers have if and when those savings are not realized?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Pugh, and welcome to the Minnesota House.
Thank you.
Those aren't my numbers. Those are Mr. Gruber's numbers, who's an MIT health economist. And I would anticipate and hope that his numbers are fairly accurate. That's the best that I can do for you. I'm not going to overpromise and say that they may call me and ask for their money back if they don't, but if they get more, I'm guessing they won't call me and give that money to me.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. I appreciate that answer. I am concerned that when taxpayers hear a dollar like that, you know, their mind is wrapped around that number and they're hopeful to look for those realizations. I would be very appreciative to see that report. I'm wondering if that might be made available to us tomorrow at tomorrow's committee meeting, if possible.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, we've got an April report, and now we've got the update for it that just came out. We've got we don't have the full hundreds of pages, I'm sure, that it would be involved in all of that and all of the underlying data, but we'll provide you what we've got from Mr. Gruber. And to your point, which is a very good one, not every family is going to save $490. Some folks at the low end, income-wise, are anticipated to save somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,700 or $1,800 a year in health insurance. Folks who earn as much money as I do will save zero on their health insurance because the tax credits will not be available to me and my family. So it's a good point to be able, the average is $490. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Atkins, it's also like I remember, and Representative Pugh's probably not old enough to remember that, but when we went to no-fault insurance, there was lots of claims in the out being thrown around that we're going to save hundreds and thousands of dollars on our auto insurance when we went to no fault, and over the years it's gone, continued to go up. So, Representative Pugh.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Atkins. So, a follow-up question to that would be that if the average Minnesota customer based on their circumstances believes that they aren't being advantaged to the degree that they expected to whom might they be able to address their grievances?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, me.
Representative Pugh.
Representative Atkins, you know, my anticipation is that average consumers would not, you know, that you would not be the one that they would see. I would anticipate that there would be you know, some sort of a somebody that people could go to follow up, and I'm wondering who that might be. If it would be individuals at the part of the exchange, would it be the board? You know, who could they address their grievances to?
Representative Atkins.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I'm not being flip. I really genuinely mean that. If they are disappointed with what the outcome is, they can contact me. I read every email. I respond to as many emails as I can, which is virtually all of them, depending on how busy we are. So I'm not looking to pass the buck. But in addition to me, under 6.12 and 1.3, there's public comment that's sought. Whenever there's changes that are being made, there's publication in the State Register. So there's plenty of opportunity, in addition to just that we've also got call-in centers and all of that sort of thing. But I didn't want to pass off or pass the buck and say that people can call me too.
Representative Pugh.
My question, Representative Atkins, my question is specifically with regard to the appeals process. I'm wondering what that would look like for the average consumer, the average taxpayer, once this exchange is in place. And the expectations were something other than what is being delivered. So I am looking for very specifics as to what the appeal process would look like.
Representative Atkins.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Pugh, what I can reference you to is the Office of Administrative Hearings in the District Court. And I'm not sure exactly how much you want me to. I've been a part of representing clients in the administrative hearing process, and I can describe how that works. I've also been involved in litigation, and I can describe how that works. But that may not be responsive to it. Those are two they're established processes, the administrative hearing process here in Minnesota and the district court process. But maybe I'm just not understanding fully what you're getting at.
Representative Pugh.
Yeah. Representative Adkins, and so would consumers have the wherewithal to appeal to the Office of Administrative Hearings, the OAH?
Representative Adkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, they have that. They also have the district court process, and finally they have the DHS process if it's relative to Medicaid or other public programs.
Representative Pugh. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm appreciative of your replies.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Representative Kahn, and if we run out of time, we can continue tomorrow. Representative Kahn.
Yes. I'm against, I was zeroing in on the rules aspect and also the 16E exemption, but since there's an amendment on that tomorrow, I think it's probably better for a fuller discussion at that time.
Okay. Representative Druskowski, can you be short, or... or do you want to take this up tomorrow?
What if we start with the first question, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Adkins, I think one of the most troubling parts of the bill was actually being discussed by Representative O'Driscoll earlier, and we heard from Representative Davids on the floor when he called this really extreme bill a place for the growth of corruption, and... he used the word corruption, and I have a lot of respect for Representative Davids, and he knows the insurance industry very well. And it appears throughout the bill, and I'm looking at the top of page 8 and in other places in the bill that are suggesting that that it's going to be up to this board to determine, basically, first of all, to attract consumers to this so-called marketplace, and then to determine which companies are going to have the ability to sell products there, to sell insurance there, and so you're essentially going to have a select board of 7 people dictating a large share of what the private market is doing right now, and. I guess this is just a comment, Representative Adkins, but I think that gets at the root of the corruption that Representative Davids talked about, and it's I do understand it really quite a lot better now. My question would be, Representative Adkins, the mandates from the federal government as states who opt to develop exchanges, and I should point out there are at least 25 states now that have opted not to enter into their own health insurance exchanges, and certainly there are reasons for that, and this state approach is not the panacea, as I understand that maybe you and others are selling it to be. But the question is, what does the federal government say about states' requirements if they do approach a state exchange? Does the federal government actually say that you have to include the government assistance programs in this exchange? Do you have to include, the Medicaid programs, and in our case, the Minnesota Care programs, and other programs? And not only this, we've got a navigator in here, which I understand, for those who may not be aware, is somebody who goes around soliciting involvement or customers, if you will, for many of the state's numerous welfare programs, which is another expansion of public assistance beyond even the health care public assistance that ostensibly this insurance exchange is going to involve. So my question is, do we have to include the public assistance programs as part of the state exchange, or could they just be private? Could it just be a private marketplace like oftentimes I think the public is led to believe that this is?
Representative Adkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, yes.
Thank you for the short answer.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I was being clipped that time, Representative Pugh. There is not a short answer to that. I would also caution against words like corruption, because they are they're loaded terms. They're also hurtful terms, and they insinuate things that I don't think you intend to insinuate. to the question itself, the federal government requires a streamlined eligibility process. We believe that we can meet that as a result of this. In order to do so, it has to have the characteristics that it does, which is, as Mr. Shepard can better describe, the relationship that it has with the state. Furthermore, I saw a figure from, I believe it was DHS, that anticipated in the millions of dollars in savings if we're able to streamline this in such a fashion that people are able to determine eligibility and enroll in the public programs via this online marketplace. So there's a lot of positive aspects to it, none of which are corrupt. And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill. I look forward to being back tomorrow.
Thank you. And members, before we lay this over, we're going to lay this over for tomorrow's hearing. Before we do that, make sure you take everything that's in your packet and put it in the save file so you have it for tomorrow. And Representative Pepin, you had a question there?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, I just noticed on the agenda it didn't list any of the people who are testifying. Do you have that list, or are you letting people testify to the last? If they come in tomorrow at 11 o'clock, will you put them on the list, or is there any way we can access a list of folks where it will be testifying?
We have a list here of people that have asked so far, and it was growing all morning long. So I'll give you the list that we have, and we'll get to them first tomorrow. And like I said, Mr. Neumeister requested that he would testify before 11 because he can't be here tomorrow. So that's why we interrupted to let him do it.
And if you could get us the list, that would be helpful. Then we know who we can expect.
So this bill is laid over till tomorrow. With that, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.